Kibu Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kibu.fm/employment.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kbu.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Jim James of My Morning Jacket and the Claypool Lennon Delirium, featuring Les Claypool and Sean Lennon, Thursday, June 27th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com. Now stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio with John and Sarah.
Hey, you're listening to KBOO. Welcome to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with Portland Assembly. Anxious news for anxious people. I'm Sarah.
I'm Jonathan.
And we are coming to you from so-called Portland, Oregon.
Unoccupied, well, none of
Did you know that there were people in parts of the South who were not informed of the end of slavery until the 1960s?
My goodness.
But, gotta say, incarceration in this country, not much change, so.
Yeah, forced sterilization of indigenous women up until the 1970s, probably still today.
Anyway, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we are going to get into some of the more nuanced topics about Goldman Sachs and some of the more related investment schemes that they have had cooking lately in Portland.
So we've been talking about the housing market in Portland and how we got where we are. That's been the focus of our last few shows. And today we want to talk about some of the major players that are taking advantage of the carrion field that our housing situation has become. We have recently seen some very interesting acquisitions. There is, aside from, well, Goldman Sachs. Do you want to talk about Goldman Sachs first?
Just a little bit, because what we've kind of been going over is how our local politicians are basically born and bred by this kind of Wall Street entity that keeps up these types of investment bubbles. And in the 80s, you know, KKR and these other housing investment corporations had basically used private pensions to buy up a bunch of land in that sweep of it and basically evacuated the pensions in the process. And now we have a new generation that's aiming at public pensions through PERS investments that Ted Wheeler was involved in to the tune of $3 billion, $4 billion now since they've tripled down or doubled down. So quite a lot of assets from public funds, from retirement funds.
Just to review, what Jonathan's referring to is the fact that about 30% of Oregon's purse funds right now are invested in these huge real estate conglomerates. So we are allowing these people to buy up all the land beneath us, rent it to us, and then we are paying them to do that, actually. And of course, because this market is entirely manufactured and inflated, all of that money that we're investing is incredibly precarious. So that's the purse funds that we're talking about, and that's one of the things that concerns us about this current bubble.
Yeah, and I'll wrap up this context quickly because there's a Rolling Stone article in particular that I think spells it out. It's a little bit vintage now, but it's called The Great American Bubble Machine. And just it states that the bank's unprecedented reach and power have enabled it to turn all of America into a giant pump and dump scam, manipulating whole economic sectors for years at a time, moving the dice game as this or that market collapses, all the time gorging itself on the unseen costs that are breaking families everywhere. High gas prices, rising consumer credit rates, half-eaten pension funds, mass layoffs, future taxes to pay off bailouts.
So that's actually really interesting because the next thing we want to talk about is this company called Cadre. And you may have noticed as you scroll through your morning news feed that there are certain companies now that are advertising to help people either buy properties like Open Door, things like that. And what that is allowing you to get in on what these major players are doing. The gamification of the housing market. The other thing that's been developing is that there are now companies capitalizing on loaning people rent money. So it's basically a glorified payday loan company, but they are rental mortgages. That should give you pause. There are multiples of these companies now, and
That's a really good example of the debt upon debt model that they work with, because now the rent is a debt to them that you're owing, and then you're taking out a loan to pay the rent, and so on and so on. Everybody's got maxed out credit cards, I'm sure, can attest that this is a cascading problem, right? Obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that Cadre does is they basically make it easier for anybody to put money into this market and therefore lose money in this market. So it's also making public all of these rental stocks. So if a large company buys, say, 35 rental buildings in the Portland area, they do the thing that everybody did, which is take kind of cheap affordable housing buildings, slap a coat of paint and a sideways fence on them, pop the rents up $400 or $500 a month, and then they bundle these. So they now own a portfolio, not a building, a portfolio. Now that these portfolios are going public, that means that you don't have one landlord, you have hundreds or perhaps thousands of landlords. That means that your rental property, the place you live, the place you pay rent on, has to perform for the market. As we know, capitalism is based on creating value for stockholders. So creating value for people who do nothing. And we are now making the very places that we live reliant on this market.
Ooh, and not only that, there's this very pernicious element of the techno-capitalist model of relying on companies like, you know, Amazon or Cadre or any of these platform, internet-based, algorithmically generated flipping machines, because that's what they do. They have Zillow now has these ETFs that basically are a form of derivative.
What's an ETF?
I forget what it's a transfer fund, but it's a type of derivative that's based off of the movement up and down of the prices. And so basically, because there's a big differential in the demand and the price, they can redouble that as a profit thing. Like, they can make more money off of it being a higher spread. So there's an incentive now with a different investment to make the spread higher, which means to drive inequality up effectively, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else does that mean? That's the only thing it means. So that on top of the leading edge of this being investment, because it's the lending that they make money off of also, so the loans to build new stuff, that's why you see all these companies courting our city officials and why Ted Wheeler has been in bed with Blackstone, who's the conglomerate we were talking about before, who was formed after the crash in 2008. In 2012, they went public, right?
Oh. So remember Cadre? I was talking about this.
2017, they went public.
I was talking about this company, Cadre.
Yeah.
You know who owns it? You know who started it?
Oh, do tell.
Jared Kushner and his brother.
Mmm.
So, yeah, and it was, and it's sustained off major investments from Blackstone, from investors out of the country, shadowy investors through Cayman Islands funds. So we don't even know where they're coming from. Warren Buffett put a bunch in.
Oh yeah, that was the loan that Warren Buffett gave them, gave Jared Kushner for like $1 billion worth of property.
So Jared Kushner, I mean, we don't get much into like national level politics, but this is super shady. He divested, quote unquote, all but less than 25%, which you know means 24.99% of the company. However, there are no records of those transactions, and none of the stockholders were ever informed that he did so. So it's entirely possible that he just didn't.
And I mean, it's especially relevant though, because the, I think it's not the CEO of Goldman, but it's some high exec, is the economic advisor of the current administration. The dude from Blackstone is like the construction and infrastructure advisor. So these are very integrated to this current administration. And this opportunity zone thing for real estate has basically made it the biggest tax haven to just evacuate the value of your investment to a different place that it exists. So everyone is rich is diving their money into it. And our mayor zoned the entirety of downtown as an opportunity zone and is basically in meetings with these guys since he was the treasurer, where he put all this money into PERS. So obviously this is a racket, right? This looks like a racket.
I mean, sometimes I wonder if they don't even know that it's a racket, if this is just their function. I don't think it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but then again, I also know that they're perfectly self-aware because they understand the market. He's a trained Ivy Leaguer.
I guess what I mean is that it's their function.
Yeah, maybe they think that they're right.
Well, okay, so let me throw this at you. I was just reading about this interesting concept called abominable fancies.
Oh.
And this is a precept that has its basis in like 2nd-3rd century Christianity. And it is basically a reward system whereby the saints, so people who are saved, people who are good, get to go to heaven. And part of their reward is watching the torments of the damned. So, and this is something that persisted well into like 1700s, 1800s in Christian theosophy. So it's a very interesting and clear connection to capitalism and the way that we as a society are perfectly okay with watching the suffering of others. And in fact, tell ourselves that we deserve that because of our toil and our industry, despite the fact that there's very little evidence that that's the case. Yeah, abominable fancy. It just seems amazingly useful for this time.
Absolutely, because that actually, I wonder, I hope someone who may know, like a historian about that could call in, but I wonder if that developed during the German era of like where the reform happened, where Protestantism was basically reformed by capitalist industrialism, right? Like that was the first Reformation, right? So that era really spawned that whole ethos.
Let's just real quick give the call-in number. So if you would like to call and ask us a question, tell us we're wrong, or just talk to us. The number here is 503-231-8187.
And this is KBOO Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Oh, where were we? Abominable fancies?
Abominable fancies.
And capitalism.
And why it's okay for there to be over 6,000 units. And that number is from 2 years ago. 16,000 empty units. Sitting in the city. Berlin is taking some interesting steps.
Oh, they get it.
Yeah. They've both instituted a vacancy tax for apartments, and then I just read,
meaning things that are empty, they tax the owner. Good call. Yeah.
And then I just read that they are putting a rent freeze in for the next 5 years.
Ooh, okay. The biggest thing I heard was about the over 3,000 unit expropriation. Like basically, if you were a corporate landlord, because only the corporate landlords are at that scale, like that's what we're talking about, is big portfolio buyers that are taking pension money to buy up property with cash. They're the cash buyers you've been hearing about for years. They're not necessarily just foreigners or Californians. They are Californians, but they're big banks who are backing it with big liquid capital they're stealing from pensions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Californian question is largely one of the past. I think that we are being so inundated by money from all over that that doesn't even really matter. We've got Sean calling in.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Here we are in the neo-feudal ecocidal wasteland.
Good morning, ecocidal wasteland.
Yeah. Labor unions obviously got de-radicalized in the McCarthy era, among other Red Scares and things like that. And my understanding is when all of the dedicated leftists were purged from unions, the mafia moved in, corporatists moved in. And so I guess the logical question would be, whatever possessed union members to allow their funds to be used in this way when Wall Street, the financial system in general, is utterly dedicated to the complete and total annihilation of the labor union movement, why isn't there more of a rank and file upswell demanding divestment from all of these schemes? David Graeber has a book out called BS Jobs, and I've seen a couple of his lectures related to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about things like the mortification of the flesh. So, like, we're modern life consists of a kind of like S&M ritual without a safe word. So, like,
yeah.
It sort of relates to what you were talking about with, like, you know, watching the suffering of others and, you know, deriding some sort of schadenfreude from that whole process. Like,
and fetishizing your own, too. That's the self-internalization of capitalism, I think, is the real detriment here, because it keeps everybody, like, incapacitated, right? You don't know how confident you should be, and you don't think you can do anything.
I totally appreciate you saying that, because, yeah, like, well, and just the whole adversarial nature of class war, like, it's like the opposite of class consciousness. It's thinking of, like, me incorporated, like, as if I am on some sort of level playing field with these massive financial institutions. So, like, could you talk about the prospects for, like, reinvigorating, like, a class-conscious labor movement and, like, divesting ourselves from this absurdity? So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Sean.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, you're right. We see America is a really weird country, same thing, when it comes to work ethic, and I put that in huge quotation marks. We see the puritanical foundations of sort of what we consider to be like white American culture. And that's very based in, you know, you have to work hard to survive, you have to, you know, mortification of the flesh, the same thing. You don't deserve anything in this life. And then the way that is twisted by capitalism and used by capital to create a pliant workforce is pretty obvious. And then you get into the 1960s and shortly after the McCarthy era and the sort of de-radicalization of a lot of movements, not just the labor movement.
COINTELPRO had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle that make mm-hmm. up neoliberalism.
Absolutely.
And neoliberalism is largely to blame. It takes away our anger, I guess.
I know the solution, a market.
Yes, we'll fix it. We'll fix it with capitalism.
More markets.
So we keep telling, you know, and we get this push for privatization and a move away from communal solutions. And those tend to be more punishing because they rely on this concept of American individualism. And that's the real killer, in my view, is that we lie to ourselves. And successful people are able to lie to themselves and tell themselves that they are successful because they are individuals. And then also people who are not considered by successful by society, that is also an individual failing. And of course, that's not true. We you know, fly or die together.
But not to mention, it's an essentialized structure. Capitalism itself requires, because it's a Ponzi scheme, that there is a top that oppresses everyone else. And so, like, that's the thing, actually, that I got to riff on a while ago that I really love about Sadia Hartman in Scenes of Subjection, is how much detail she brings out in the case for these the particular sadism of American capitalism being drawn from the evolution of chattel slavery here and breeding people for the purpose of labor. And you had said, like, to perform for the market, and how essentialized that was to the existence of a slave in that society, where they had to appease the white people who are uncomfortable, so they make them sing happy songs while you're going down the road in a chain gang, you know?
Well, and then that's literally the base unit. That's literally the base unit of capitalism and American growth.
That is what created the dollar value.
Yeah.
And the property is what, you know, enabled it. Let's go to Linda on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Linda.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask you, I wanted to say a couple things and ask you one thing. The thing I'd like to say is, I'd like to see us really, and I mean this honestly, not as an exaggerated thing, call for a moratorium on all multi-story, multi-unit building for residential. In other words, the last thing I heard was 18,000 empty units. Joanne Hardesty used that number publicly recently. Is that we set up absolutely moratorium. We will not give any development permits for them unless they're actually low income, for low income people. And we dovetail that with the second part of that is that we demand an $18 an hour now, because we can't get people off the streets if they can't get in, if they can't earn an income enough to be able to rent a place. And we can't rent a place because of this horrible market. So we need to stop that effing market, force those.
I got a better way to start the market.
I put a tax on the empty ones at the same time, you know, until it rights itself again, because it's not going to right itself in any natural way that they like to claim it will.
Markets don't right themselves. Markets are just adjusted with more market strategies.
And
pushes. And maybe this is all this is, and I'm not talking about revolution at this minute, but I'm talking about that there might be regions and cities where we could pull off something like that, an actual moratorium on building, residential buildings, multi-story, and only law, and they can build in our city only if they're going to build for low income. And I think we should really push for it, because we need a real actual solution. So that's my one thing. I'd like you guys to comment on it. But the other thing I'd like you to talk to is, when I talk to people about these empty apartments, they go, well, how does anybody make any money off that? Where is the money coming? And I think it's that there's money at each level of whether you sell it or buy it or what you do. But I don't really have the information to explain that well to people. And I'm hoping you do, or you know a really good article that will. And then I'll just let you comment. I'll go off the line. I've got a bad cough. And
all right.
You don't
thank
want to
you.
Hear it, so. All right, thank you.
Appreciate you, Linda.
Thanks for calling. If you look at the link, the Wednesday Morning Radio page on the KBOO website, there are a bunch of article links that are pretty good explainers for this. I would also say, and let me just give the call-in number for anybody that wants to comment. It's 503-231-8187. So one of the things that we've been talking about is this bundling of properties, and that's where the money is that it's no longer about that apartment itself. And that's why we say it doesn't matter if it's empty or full. Where they're making the money is on the future derivatives of that property bundle. So basically, all of these apartments are commodities on the stock market. They exist, and you can bet on their continued existence and whether or not their value is going to rise or fall. Money is made on all of those transactions regardless of what's going on in the physical apartment. That's one of the things that's troubling, is that the vast majority, you know, if the vast majority of rental property is owned by entities that don't care about it as a physical place for a person to live, there's going to be a huge disconnect. And that's what we're seeing. And I got to say, the things that you're talking about, the market controls, that's more neoliberalism. And one of the things that we want to get away from is continuing to inflate the housing market when housing is a human right. So
UN agrees.
The UN agrees.
Yeah, this isn't just us being crazy leftists or whatever.
Definitely are not looking for more money to be put in these people's pockets. We are looking for city and state controls that allow us to give people housing. I don't think that we should be worrying about whether or not someone can pay rent or pay a deposit when what they need is shelter. And I think, again, the concept that I brought up before, abominable fancies, we tell ourselves that these people deserve this. We use terms like service resistant. And those things are lies. Those things are things that we say to mollify the bad feelings that we get by watching things go on every day that we know are absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. We have the ability to do this. We have places for people to live. We have political tools to do this. Things like eminent domain could be leveraged against Goldman Sachs to take buildings to let people live in for free.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason we don't do this is because we have spent the last 300 years, 500 years telling ourselves that these people deserve what they get and that we deserve what we have. And none of that is true.
And not only that, the thing that's essentialized about the city mechanism of supporting itself is that that is to game these zoning differences for land value increase. Like, it's basically written in, if you read stuff from the 1913s and so on, or, you know, the teens before the crashes, especially when they were lending out a bunch of fake money in a similar fashion, it really does look the same as previous bubbles, and it's all been driven by colonial expansion, so they're completely inseparable. That's kind of been another point on the show we've been trying to make. And Joanne in particular is upsetting because I've begun to hear some YIMBY rhetoric coming out of what she's trying to say. Need affordable, blah, 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 based off of market rate. Market rate is defined by these banks. Market rate will not fix this, and land is not a commodity. You can't go make more land to make it go down.
Well, I think one of the things that we have talked about before is that the lies that are told the most, or the things that are said the most, are the biggest lies. We keep talking about housing stock, and I hear it from both sides that both there's sides. Not enough housing stock.
Yeah.
We're not NIMBYs or YIMBYs, by the way. We think you're all wrong.
Or FIMBYs, I guess. Public housing in my backyard.
Yeah, public housing in my backyard. We've got another caller. Joe, what's up?
Hi, I'm from California. I live in Santa Barbara.
Right on, Joe.
So does my landlord.
Can you find them?
It's not that bad.
What's up?
Well, I have one thing to, well, a couple things. One thing I was looking at, there was a $1 billion settlement for the people that lost their lives in the in Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
That GE decided to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So what if we wanted stock instead of money?
How do you mean?
Well, instead of they get a cash out where they just, you know, it's a bar tab basically for what they're paying, is that instead of money, we get stock and become stockholders in the company.
I mean, I'd advocate for public ownership of public services. So, you know, your electricity, your water, like, that should all be municipally owned.
Oh, yeah, it used to be.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't have to used to pay for water. Definitely would say that moving away from privatization and back to municipal control mm-hmm. is the way to go. And unfortunately, I don't know that the government of California is going to try to leverage that. But yeah, we would fully endorse that.
I just wondered if that's possible to do, because the thing is that who's making the money? So the shareholders. So well, if we take up their stock, then they're gonna feel the crunch more than just the money payout, which they're probably insured for.
So I absolutely hear you, and this is kind of one of the bigger problems that's harder for me to explain to people, but this is a good example to talk about why the money is a problem. When we're talking about the total system of money and how many pieces of money are in the system, right, most of that is soaked up into this sponge of,
right.
And they also, by creating these new loans and only issuing them to other capitalists and other investors and other people who have the access to that, they create this bubble above the real labor. And so it's all this,
like stock buybacks, right?
And that's exactly what they're doing. Goldman Sachs
used to be illegal at one time.
Correct. And it got Glass-Steagall was repealed, and yeah, now there's a nice fusion of that plus the commercial banking
position, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. We got another caller, Joe. We got to let you go, but we appreciate you, bud.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for calling. Meg?
Hi.
Hey.
Hey, I really appreciate your show.
Thanks for calling.
And so a couple comments, too. I think you're doing a great job, too, of explaining how things have been bundled up and financialized. And I think that one of the previous callers was trying to get a grasp on where the money's coming from vacant units. And I think the more that you sort of repeat these themes that talk about financialization, I think people understand the abstracts of the stock market and shares. And if I own a share, I don't have to do anything with it. As long as it keeps appreciating in value and keeps getting traded, then I can sell it and make money. I can hold it. I don't have to do anything with it. And I think that it's just as abstract when we're talking about real estate. People tend to think that real estate and the value of real estate is connected to its social utility. And repeating this new truth that this says, you know, it's financialized and we have a deregulated financial market, and housing is a high yield commodity completely divorced from that social utility. Think of it like those stocks, like those abstracts, and this idea that it just conjures money. And I think one of the things you just hit on that really resonated with me too is sort of this idea of just taking a look at all of the money, the public money that is being extracted from us, the value of the land, the value of our labor, and now in this everything bubble where all of this debt and all of the value has been financialized and hedged on both sides so that somebody else wins when everybody else loses, that this is ultimately all, you know, it's all our value. And to wake up, recognize that, and then to try to say, like, how do we take this back? How do we take back and start taking out those siphons and recognizing that all of this wealth is being extracted from us? I'll leave you with this too, just to quantify that a little bit. I came across a number that just here in Portland last year, 2018, renters in the Portland area paid over $4 billion just in rent. that's the value of our rent checks. And then when you take into account financialization, it's just it's ridiculous. So thank you for these continued discussions. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Meg. We appreciate you. And real quick, just because I think that financialization point is important, but the sentiment of taking back, I disagree with that one, just because this was built around and for these types of people since the inception of colonization. Like, this would be a decolonial process. Sam Stein, actually, the author of Capital City, a good book, I think that we've discussed it before with you, actually, in particular, had brought up the case for a need for an anti-capitalist planning strategy because of the fact that this whole derivative function of the way that this wealth has been conjured is extractive in a way that is counter to the way things actually will work in a pro-social society.
Well, and so if you look at the legislation that we are actually offered to fix these problems, quote unquote, I watched this, the RIP battle, the residential infill project battle, and that's something we should have been fighting 10 years ago. That is so not even the question anymore. We're writing legislation and pushing for bills that don't fix problems that we are looking at now. So I also think that we get into trouble there.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's definitely it's also parallel to some of the other concepts we've talked about on the show before, actually, you know, especially with the big Google investments and things like that and infrastructure in San Francisco lately demonstrate this relationship between these factions of what this guy, Peter Madroff from UC Santa Cruz, calls the growth coalition that we've talked about, where the city seeks to profit off of the land, the developers seek to profit off of the land, and the landowners especially seek to profit off the land and can jack up the price as it becomes more valuable.
Well, if we get rent control in at only, what, 7% a year? Is that what it was?
That was like guaranteed returns, right?
Right, that is a guaranteed return for those shareholders that we're talking about. All they have to do is raise these millions of rents a little bit every year, and that's still a return on their investment.
And it's doubling in 10 years. 7% return increase per year. That's the scary thing about compounding interest and so on. And that's really the problem with financialization. It's like compounding interest is an example of what they're doing. They're multiplying the debt money that they have by issuing more loans to mm-hmm. call it more money. That doesn't have any productive tie at all.
So putting more money into the market is never going to be the answer that's going to push us in the direction we want,
mm-hmm.
That we think like actually benefits people. So let's go to our next caller. We have Mitch.
Yes, you had a call out on stuff that has written not just in complicated academic journals, but just the regular media about what's happening in cities with this rent speculation. And I wanted to call people's attention to probably one of the most accessible explanatory pieces that ran in the UK's Guardian newspaper by a woman who's been teaching in America since the 70s on this very subject, and her name is Saskia Sassen. And the article is titled, Who Owns Our Cities and Why This Urban Takeover Should Concern Us All. It was published on the 24th of November, 2015, and it discusses the huge post-credit crunch buying up of urban buildings by corporations that has significant implications for what she calls equity, democracy, and rights. And then she goes ahead and explains how this works as vision for investors all over the world to park their capital in these public-private partnerships that develop not low-income housing, which is what our president's family got rich building 30 years ago, but market rate, which is a code word for not actually filling them because job wages are not going up enough to fill these new developed empty buildings, but simply as speculative vehicles on the global capital markets. So I think it's a very useful article, a link to your website, and it's published by The Guardian.
Thank you. We'll go take a look for that, and I'll put it on the Portland Assembly page, but also when the link page is up for this show, I'll link it in the comments there.
Mm-hmm. Also, having been a student of Saskia's back in the 70s at Queens College in New York, I can tell you that she's very accessible to community radio interviews, and I'm always shocked that she isn't sourced.
Maybe we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
And she teaches in America, so just call her up at her wherever she's teaching now and just ask her for a phone interview.
Thanks. That's a great tip. We will definitely take a look.
Ted Wheeler on another line would be fun.
Let's watch that battle.
I don't think he'd talk to us.
No.
Well, thank you for what you're doing.
Sure. Thanks for calling in. We also, I'll also make sure that there's some more links available on that page. We've developed a pretty extensive catalog at this point of the various articles and explainers written on this. And we'll definitely make more of those available for folks because, it's not like they want you to pay attention to this.
Right. And actually, go ahead, if you'd like, on the KBOO page for the show, which we did post from our Portland Assembly page, you can post it as a link there. And just as a refresher, this is KBOO Talk Radio on 90.7 KBOO, right? we're here talking about Goldman Sachs and techno flipping with these cadre investment platforms and what that means for the capital city model. And actually, to comment on Mitch, our last caller, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had said something about how this was integrated into development. And this is something that's been noted since, I think, analysis of capitalism started, because even Engels, the Marxist Engels fame, and I don't like Engels, but he did have a point when he was talking about the city core being an epicenter for capitalist development, and that this is an integral structure to that. So this, if anything, is a structural, physical representation of the ideology of capitalism. And so the poverty that comes with that is also structural. So we need to stop structuring things this way, is what Sam Stein is saying, in order to fix that. And I agree. We need structurally public housing. That's what we need, yeah. Immediately.
Yeah. Let's go to our next caller, Felicity.
Hi. I just had a question about our focus when we talk about low-income housing, we tend to focus mostly on rental units. And why is it that we don't have more of a focus on home ownership for low-income people? Because as long as you're renting, I mean, you have that monthly burden of your rent payment for the rest of your life. And if we can put more of a focus on making home ownership more accessible, then, I mean, once you own the house, then you're not paying money to this corporation, because, I mean, it's mostly your landlord isn't an individual who owns the home. It's like this big conglomerate. So why is the focus just on renting and not on home ownership?
Well, I would say because the industry has purposefully pushed it in that direction. Home ownership has become increasingly hard to reach for people, and now we kind of see why. And then, of course, with the subprime mortgage bubble, so many people were talked into houses they couldn't afford, which left us with the 2008 situation. And I think that one of the things we have to recognize is that this doesn't work because the real estate industry is fundamentally unsound and unsustainable. So this is not, in order for people to acquire basic housing, just shelter, they should not have to work 40 to 60 hours a week. We're in a situation now where
shouldn't have to work.
The market, well, you shouldn't have to work. The market is untenable. But so we have to recognize that buying houses isn't necessarily the way we want to go. So we talk a lot about land trust models. And we're very interested in trying to establish community land trusts, indigenous land trusts, with an effort to return land, and that sort of thing, because we recognize that the financialization of the increase of that value isn't one that's tenable. We don't want a model like Proud Ground, which basically becomes your landlord. What we want...
It also looks to improve the value of the properties, and they're seeking to profit in a way. They're a nonprofit, but they're trying to raise the value for everybody.
Right, which, you know, from a neoliberal standpoint makes sense, but if you're trying to end the market and allow access... That's all a market is. All a market is something that puts up barriers so that people can't get what they want, and what they need, more importantly.
But inherently, you'd said something about talked into these loans. I think that's even a little bit disingenuous, just because the people who really drove this liminal edge of the problem that blew up the entire world market were the people who were flipping. And so now this is why I'm especially scared. It's not just your, you know, noob investors who are going and getting too hot in the seat. It's computer programs. It's literally algorithms that are doing the flipping. So now we have rentals that they got from that bust on purpose. They blew it up on purpose and clapped up all the property. They took that value, and now they're investing in bigger stuff, infrastructure, city, municipal bonds.
I feel like that's one of the reasons that the whole mom and pop landlord narrative is a red herring.
Yeah.
Because yes, these people are also affected by markets, but they profit by the lobbying that these huge companies do. They profit by the legislation that is then enacted. And I'm going to say that if, as a small landlord, your situation doesn't allow you to do what you need to do, that you're a canary in the coal mine. You are an indicator that this quote-unquote industry should not exist.
And we'll get to it, I think, or I'd like to get to it after we take Arthur, is still on the line, I believe. But that model of techno capital and now this new stuff about Amazon being behind Palantir, which we knew already, but it being the backbone of ICE, was, you see this essentialized criminal carceral model baked into the techno capital. And now you also see them moving into issuing money. So they want to be the bankers. Basically.
Facebook is going to be the bank and Amazon's going to be the army.
Exactly. Libra, yeah. Libra coin is. All right, so let's take Arthur. Good morning,
hi,
Arthur.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
I was a contractor in Oregon for 3 or 15 years in construction, and I know the good ones and the bad ones, and I got one that's so bad you just gotta laugh.
Development
proposal that's exaggerated, right? It's so bad. It's such a bad. It's called the Tiger Triangle, and they're building two new apartment multi-stories, and they're calling it the Pearl District. Are you still with me here?
Yep.
Yeah, the Pearl District. Okay.
The Pearl District of Tiger, right? It's first two new ones, and the several that they've got, they all face the parking lots of a Costco, a Walmart, a Regal Cinema, and a Homes Depot, and then behind them, they got the Ford dealership.
Oh, my goodness.
That's like the Pearl. You drink to that one, okay? That's the funniest one. And the others, well, Barber Boulevard, that's exaggerated. Everything on Barber Boulevard is up in the air, and you tell the planners that if they ran the light rail from Tiger to Alton along to Beaverton, where there's a rail corridor to do it at, then it would make sense for the development that's proposed to be single-family homes, 9,000 units in the Tiger to Alton Beaverton area. So they're going to add this much, but they're not doing the train ride. Putting it on Barber's is a huge mistake.
And they're probably going to charge an arm and a leg that you can't afford anyway, right? And it's all garbage property.
Well, and this is the way they run the zone.
Especially facing a Walmart. That'll be workers. That'll be some large. That's not that much. It's not huge at all. It'll be like a little tiny neighborhood for workers to go shop or get in their cars and deliver goods. Oh, boy. That'll be it. Amazon Central there.
Yeah.
You got to laugh at that, too. Okay.
You got to be a Prime citizen with your Prime account. No, it's going to happen.
All right. You got me on that, those two projects, the light rail. So poor engineering, according to all the rail experts. Bus rapid transit would do better on Barber. All right. Bye now.
Right on.
Thanks. Well, and we can see across the country that when they do these transit improvement districts, like, we know what their goals are. It's the way that these districts overlay. We talked before about opportunity zones, and now Cadre is offering particular incentives in certain areas which overlay with these opportunity zones in cities like Portland and LA and Austin.
Which we would love to talk to folks from, whoever's on that portfolio map, because Cadre has a portfolio map. Let's meet up. Let's link up. Everyone federate with us, please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you are organizing for these issues in another city and you want to talk, hit up our page. Let's go to our next caller. I think we have Carl?
I believe it's Carl, right?
Carl.
Yeah.
Hey, Carl. What's up?
Hey, I'm down in Houston, and I'm Texas, and first time listening to y'all's program.
Right on.
Thanks for calling.
Really enjoying it. I have one question, and it was kind of like just a thread that you're talking about, maybe reducing the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, so, and my thoughts were that that's what we need to do to help with climate change. You know, it's just downsized economy. So I'm just wondering if you have time or interest in riffing on that a little bit.
Well, actually, we have a lot of interest in riffing on that. So we're...
Let's destroy work. Let's destroy the economy.
We want to build an anti-capitalist city, and I think we can do that. And I think that Portland is probably a good place to start. There are so many systems that could be localized. There are so many things that we could do for ourselves.
Not only that, it would be happier and healthier to live in that, I suspect.
Yeah.
We have talked about different types of, there are just so many networks and systems that can be established. Networks for collecting say, like food waste and excess food and distributing it, systems for transportation. And honestly, like for us, a lot of the answers to this mean localization, and keeping things in your neighborhood, in your city, accessible. Being able to barter or trade with other businesses, being able to set up cooperative businesses that handle our needs municipally and are able to work with each other. We think a lot about networks. We think about it kind of rhizomatically, so that these things are naturally developing. That
self-managing.
Yeah. So, you know, if your community finds that it needs something, and the barriers to access, those monetary barriers primarily, are removed, it can build what it needs.
Faster, most of the time.
Yeah, and more efficiently.
Yeah, and to that end, it's definitely early in the works, but we've done a lot of work over the past few years with a longtime coalition of houseless organizers in the city who are really good, RAP and Sisters of the Road and Right to Survive and folks like that, and now Vos Worker Center again, who you should check them out. They're going to need some help with their legal observers. I don't know if everyone's paying attention to what ICE is doing, but it's going to get real heady for people like that, so if you are able to reach out to your local orgs that are doing work to prevent that. OHO training is legal observer training. Definitely go take it. But they are looking to potentially start something that's kind of a recycling cooperative around a guy that we had met around town who you should check out because he's an independent inventor guy. But he invented this thing called Metabolizer and some machines that process plastic from precious plastic, which is an open source movement you can check out. And the goal is to develop something that's self-sustaining and creates useful objects for people who are in a dispossessed state from capitalism to get them back on their feet and get them to be a part of these kind of self-actualized communities that Right to Survive has been forming.
And moreover, to build networks of supply, to build supply chains that are not fundamentally based on capitalism.
Right, yeah.
Should we go to our next caller?
Probably, yes.
Hey, well, thanks for calling, Mark. That was a great question. Our next caller is Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I like the idea of this non-capitalist economy, but, you know, you were talking about housing. It seemed like that was a big focus of this discussion and how the labor or the housing markets, quote unquote, aren't working, but they seem to be working okay if you have money. And the question I guess I have is, you know, it seems that one of the big problems is wages are too low.
Oh, and, yes.
And so you really need to, if you were able to raise wages, that would fix a million problems. And how does that fit in with your concept of a non-capitalist economy? And I'll just hang up and let you guys talk about that.
No, right on. That's cool. That segues with a lot of feelings that I have, right? So particularly the issue that I see right now with trying to petition your company that you work for is that they already have a legal framework that supports them. So the kind of force that recuperation of unions has shown to bear, where you get neutralized, you get buyouts, you get this kind of corporatization of unions when they're a separate party from the business itself because they're divided, right? You can do that. So like as this transitionary model, I see a real advantage in creating parallel economies that are run at a horizontal level through self-managed worker enterprises, but that's not the end goal, right? The end goal is to create enough abundance that you don't have to have work be the critical function of the society, where you're moving away from that as the predominant mode of organizing society. So you can focus on people's actual needs and well-being over the compulsory work and need to be at a certain place at a certain time at all times.
I also think, so if we look at say, the Fight for 15, which is gaining predominance, we have guarantees of what, by 2020, we're supposed to be paying $15 an hour minimum wage. That is not enough to pay rent on an apartment in any city in America right now. So when we talk about these, like getting people more money and stuff, that type of reform tends to take so long that it's pretty much unnecessary or completely inadequate by the time it's actually like achieved. And so it makes more sense to make the things that people need actually accessible for them than to actually put more money into the pockets of greedy exploiters so that people can live.
Yeah. That's a really good point, because they already consolidate all this money, as we were talking about before. And I've said this on the show before with Paul, actually, that this, I think, is the exodus of major capitalist enterprise from the United States economy, which basically means this is the pump and dump of the U.S. dollar, in my opinion. So you have all these big investment entities effectively getting in on the last driving sector of the economy, which we have industrial capitalism no more. Like, there's no more industrial capitalism in the States per se. It's all been virtualized. We outsource the labor. So most of what we have in our economy, like the fifth of it, is FIRE, which is finance and real estate. And all of that is this circular feedback of conjuring wealth upon debt. So it's literally funny money that's driving the value of the dollar right now, in my opinion. And I think that they're just waiting to short it on the other side, like they did with the pound in the 90s and like they've done with other world currencies. They've done it.
Well, and in a realistic sense, if you've got somebody who is extorting money from you,
mm-hmm.
like, so your landlord is asking you for $1,600 a month for a one-bedroom apartment.
For nothing.
And you used to pay $1,200 a month.
Yeah.
The
increase is to ignore your dryer request again. Yeah.
So either you can try to get more money at work and give that more money that you get at work directly to your landlord, or the city or state can work on something to subsidize your rent, which is effectively the state giving money directly to your landlord, or we can just take the landlord out of the situation.
Which the city's happy to do for property owners. They took all the property in North Portland from the black community there, didn't really do anything with their still empty lots, but they took it with eminent domain. And mm-hmm. they were supposed to have right compensation. There's still people waiting on their checks, and they were like $3,000 because they depreciated the value. It was a total scam and a fleece, and they should feel bad and use eminent domain for public housing, just saying.
So while we recognize that reform is probably the way it'll happen, we push back against that, and we would prefer just to destroy the market in its entirety. We've got another, is it another Mark, or are we going to Robbie now? Oh, hello, another Mark. What can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for a great show. You should be on at least monthly.
Oh, we are. I think.
Every third Wednesday, we'll be here.
Yes.
Oh, great.
And this is KBOO Talk Radio. Thank you. Wednesday morning.
Elected officials should feed and house. The Vienna Housing Fund buys up potential property and prevents speculation, and the rents in Vienna are half the rents in Munich.
Correct.
That's beautiful. We love that idea. First now, refusal?
I uploaded an article on Portland Indie Media titled Save the Downtown Food Carts, so I recommend it. We shouldn't be building a 35-story, out-of-scale monstrosity.
Oh, the hotel.
Downtown.
It's a hotel, too. Luxury hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to mention high-frequency trading. Stocks are not held for 10 years or for 6 months or even 22 seconds. The average time is now 10 seconds.
That's the techno capital. Yeah, and they're running by quantum computers, man.
Algorithms are buying algorithms.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's a bizarre, our bizarre reality.
We got, I hear you. We got a couple more callers to get to, though. We only got 3 minutes, though, but we appreciate you. You got anything to say in the last second?
4-day work week makes happiness on all kinds of levels.
We should have a municipally guaranteed 2-day work week. I think that'd be cool. We can do that. You just have to make stuff that is abundant, like food and, you know, everything else.
Well, and real quick, that's one of the problems, and why your employer doesn't want to pay you more is because as automation comes in, they don't have to. And
you can move anywhere.
We can either do this in a way that gives us 2-day work weeks, or we can do this in a way where we're all houseless. Let's move on to our next caller, Robbie.
Hey, I love the conversation, really enjoying it. I just wanted to give your listeners some more tools and some great ideas. First and foremost, I'm not against raising the minimum wage. I just don't think it's going to do anything that's, I mean, it's like a Band-Aid on the thing. You know, we got to go after the deeper problem, right? And so when I see when people want to talk about raising the minimum wage, ultimately what's going to happen is just kind of that inflation. Now, second point, the inflation that's already happening – I want to shoot this idea. I'm writing my second book currently, and it's about this idea of, instead of allowing the Federal Reserve, because we need to understand where the money comes from. The Federal Reserve issues fiat money in the form of, you know, this cloud-based currency, which you were talking about, you know, the manipulating of currencies. What I was going to suggest is, why do we let the Federal Reserve print money for the banks to issue in the form of debt to the people on business loans? We should be allowing hospitals, the fire, the teachers. We should be printing money for the social services that are having a hard time making profit off of it. Anyway, I just wanted to share it all.
Link to our page. Topic. We want to talk about backing
Come
money
to the
by that.
Portland Assembly Facebook page, and let's talk about Portland Coin.
Yeah, because we would like to back it to all those things.
Thanks, everybody who called in.
That was an excellent show.
Yeah, thanks very much. So we are Sarah and John, Anxious News for Anxious People from Portland Assembly.
And at 9, it's Making Contacts. It explores the history of Juneteenth and expands the conversation of Juneteenth to include a case for reparations, which we wholeheartedly support and think municipal entities could do much more for, using eminent domain even.
And then coming up at 9:30, it's Radio Zine. 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11 it's The Food Show.
All right, and don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, just like you. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click Donate. Please donate all the time. We love KBOO. Become a subscriber. They do it every month. It's easy.
Thank you so much.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise,